Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of March. Joining us in just a few minutes, Martha Raddatz will be here. Martha is the author of The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family. She's the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and the network's former senior national security correspondent. She's won a number of Emmys. She has covered national security and foreign policy for more than 12 years, appears regularly on World News, Nightline, Good Morning America. She's also a regular panelist on PBS's Washington Week, and she has made frequent trips to Iraq since the U.S. invasion. She says that most Americans have no clue of the depth of the people in the military or the diversity or just what they deal with every day. This book chronicles an ambush on April 4 of 2004 of an Army platoon on a routine peacekeeping mission in Sauter City, just hours after their arrival from Fort Hood, Texas. None of the soldiers had ever seen combat. None had of the soldiers, nor had any of the soldiers in the four convoys who were in the area as well. In the end here, 8 U.S. soldiers were dead, 60 were wounded, and she first covered the battle and its aftermath in a series of reports for ABC Nightline, and now certainly in much more depth in The Long Road. And we're going to be talking about the book this hour of the program. She says she returns to Iraq every few months just to be with the troops. I just feel I have a stake in it. It's the number one story on the White House beat. The president knows I go over there. He asks me when I get back how it was or what I saw. He is very respectful of that, and that's a good thing for me. She also, in this book, it goes back and forth between what's happening in Iraq and what's happening with the families who are at home and what it's like to be in a military family. She also says that the soldiers and their wives have told her that they see her as a bridge between the civilian world and themselves, sometimes a bridge between the soldiers and their wives. In some respects, this book, Martha says, has become the after-the-action report, the power of the emotions and the fear and the courage these soldiers experienced. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Martha, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Hello, Martha. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen.
This is quite a story, isn't it? These poor guys, you know, they just get over there and, oh my gosh, I'd love the way you weave back and forth what the families were thinking and how they were dealing with all of this at home, the time difference, et cetera. These people who are arriving in Iraq and literally hours after they arrived almost are involved in this battle, which really, as you call it, is a turning point in the war in Iraq.
And so unexpected, because they really did believe they were on a peacekeeping mission, because in Sauter City the previous year before they got there, there had been one soldier killed. It had been relatively peaceful there throughout. And the Americans assumed, because it was a largely Shiite area, an area that had been badly oppressed under Saddam Hussein, that they would be grateful that the Americans were there, and that did not turn out to be the case.
And yet some of them said, when they were emailing home, that they sensed that something wasn't quite right. It didn't seem as peaceful as they thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's one of those horrible moments that if they'd had 2 more weeks on the ground, if the 1st Cavalry Division had had 2 more weeks on the ground, they would have absolutely known what was going on and this wouldn't have happened. But because they'd just gotten there, because the communications gear was not operating yet, all these different events just made that one moment happen and made them far more vulnerable.
Tell me exactly what happened on that day in April in 2004.
Well, the 1st Cav had just arrived, as you said, and literally the very moment they took command, gunfire started ringing out in the city. There was a platoon, 19 men and one Iraqi translator, that was just coming back from a patrol, and all they were doing on this patrol was escorting sewage trucks. They had Iraqis going around in sewage trucks sucking up the sewage. This is a horribly poverty-ridden area. The sewage runs through the street. And when the platoon came back and the sewage trucks took off, they were trapped. They were under intense intense gunfire. I mean, the descriptions, and if you've read them in the book, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just
yes.
amazing. And rocket-propelled grenades. They were in 4 Humvees. Mm. They were down to 2 Humvees. 2 were burning. A gunner was dead almost immediately, and they had to take refuge in an alley. So they blocked off 2 of the Humvees. The rest of their soldiers ran into a house to set up a defensive position, and they called for help. The hardest part was getting the help in there. First of all, they had vehicles not made for war. Mm-hmm. They had what are called LMTVs, and basically those are big supply trucks. But the soldiers back at the base camp were so intent on rescuing these other soldiers who were trapped in the city that they were jumping into anything they could to get in there. They had Humvees with only canvas tops. I know we've heard a lot about adding on armor to some of these Humvees. These Humvees that a lot of these soldiers went out in that night had no protection from above, from the side.
Oh my.
Some didn't even have doors. So in the next 2 hours, the 1st Cavalry Division lost 8 soldiers and had more than 70 wounded. It was the largest loss of life for the 1st Cavalry Division in a single day since the Vietnam War. And meanwhile, back home, I mean, this is the story that I really wanted to tell, is the wives getting the news the same day. It happened to be Palm Sunday. And, of course, they wake up. Baghdad is 9 hours ahead of them. They have no idea that some of the soldiers have died, that many were wounded, and they just went about their days. It took hours before they started getting word back. I mean, these were women who were just getting used to the fact that their husbands were deployed for a year, and they hadn't been separated from their husbands for more than 2 weeks. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, the Army, they must be used to that. But these men hadn't been to war before. They'd been in the minivans 4 days later, and suddenly they're in their Humvees in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So the women start getting word that 2 of them have died, that 4 of them have died, that 8 of them have died.
Mm. You talk about this as being this particular battle as a crucial turning point in the war in Iraq. How so, Martha?
I think because it's the first time the U.S. military was attacked in such large numbers. It's the first time they realized, you know what, maybe they don't want us here. Maybe there are people who are going to fight against us. And to have not just the Mahdi militia, Muqtadir al-Sadr's militia out on the streets, but civilians from Sadr City, children, old men, teenagers, everyone out on the street. There were literally thousands of people out there trying to kill Americans. So I think that was just eye-opening. They fought 80 straight days after that. It was really the beginning of where we are now. And you know in the news that Sadr City, where this battle began, is now one of the keys to success. It is so far from over in Sadr City. Muqtada al-Sadr still rules Sadr City without question. He is in control of Sadr City. And many other parts of Baghdad as well are under his influence.
Tell the story, Martha. There's so many stories of heroism, and it's amazing to read about what people will do even though they may not think of themselves as heroic initially. Staff Sergeant Milton Berger, last guy to volunteer for anything, wanted out of the Army, and yet he was there and performed so heroically.
He did, and I was grateful that I was able to see Staff Sergeant Milton Berger and his wife last night, and it was just wonderful to see him.
Oh.
He and Sergeant Swope, I brought them to Washington because I wanted them to meet some people here, and it was wonderful for them to see each other for the first time since then. It was absolutely heartwarming. But Milton Berger is one of those guys. He's a terrific guy, and when I first met him, kind of a grumpy guy, and you think, oh boy, he's not going to tell me anything. And he was on what's called stop loss, which is the small print in your military contract that says if your unit is deployed, you can't get out if they don't want you to get out. So he was set to retire after 20 years in the military, and he couldn't. He had to go to Iraq. But that night, in the back of one of those trucks, in fact, there is one picture that exists from that night of one of those trucks, and I describe that. It is the eeriest picture to me because it's just as this rescue truck goes in to Sadr City, and it just looks so incredibly vulnerable. It just minutes after it turns onto this road, and you can see one tire is already flat. You can just make out Sergeant Milton Berger behind the cab of the truck, his helmet leaned forward, saving the lives of 2 soldiers, one who was paralyzed, one who had a what's called a sucking chest wound. And Sergeant Miltenberger, he had a hand on the weapon. He had a knee on one of the femoral artery bleeds. He had another hand on the sucking chest wound. He was just extraordinary. And then he's now living in a FEMA trailer because he retired from the military finally when he got back, and his house was destroyed in the hurricane.
Oh, gee.
But they're doing wonderfully, and they have a great attitude. And, you know, someone said last night to him, if there's anything we can do for you, he said, look, sir, as long as I have a place to sleep, I'm fine. I don't need anything.
Mm.
And he, you know, he was awarded the Silver Star. He doesn't consider himself a hero. He doesn't like to talk about that. But, boy, he sure is in my eyes.
Mm-hmm. You read these stories, and it makes you angry because of they don't have the equipment they need, et cetera. You say, though, here's the thing, that you can't function. This is what the soldiers are saying. You can't function in Iraq and be angry about this. The overwhelming sentiment in the military is we're here now. We've got to do what we've got to do. We've got to win this.
I mean, that's exactly right. And many of the same guys, many of the same soldiers in this book are now back in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I was there just a couple of weeks ago. The battalion commander, for instance, Lieutenant Colonel, now Colonel Gary Valesky, is over there again for another year-long deployment. I've talked to his wife, his family. I mean, they're terribly supportive. And Colonel Valesky has the same attitude. It's just we are here, why we got here. You can debate that forever, but we're here. We have to do the best job we can. And, you know, this was a very complicated situation in terms of the equipment. You can look at it and say they didn't have any of the right equipment for this battle, and that's true. But the reason they didn't is because they expected a peacekeeping mission. So you can't take a bunch of tanks in there and Bradleys and go rumbling down the street of an urban neighborhood where if you open fire with one of those guns, you could have lots of innocent people killed. Nor can you go down those streets with that kind of message. So that, to me, was also a turning point. They realized that they had to be prepared for anything over there. I mean, they had some tanks, they had some Bradleys, they had some armored Humvees, but for that particular battle, they were unprepared.
You return to Iraq every few months to be with the troops. You say, I just feel that I have a stake in it. It's certainly the number one story. But there's something else that makes you go back, I think, Martha, and I want you to talk a bit about that. This is a very dangerous assignment for journalists, and talk about Bob Woodruff here if you would like to. And it's a hard thing to do. So I'm wondering about the depth of your commitment to this story and where that comes from.
I do have a deep commitment to this story, and I think it is because I have been doing it for so long.
Mm.
And I, probably like the American troops, never imagined when this began that it would go so long. And I feel like I've had a unique perspective. I've covered this story from the Pentagon, from the State Department, mm-hmm. now from the White House, and 12 trips to Iraq. And I feel that I have made that commitment, and I have seen over these years different things that I can gauge progress or not. It is terribly dangerous. You cannot say it isn't. Mm. In fact, I saw Bob Woodruff last night as well, too.
Oh, you
and
did.
He is doing so wonderfully and followed his progress on over all these months. And I know the very first time I saw him after he was injured, I just knew it was the same Bob and he would be back. I'll tell you how my family feels about it. My daughter, who's 26 and in law school, has spoken eloquently and written eloquently mm-hmm. about her support for this as well. And I think it also comes from when you are close to members of the military, when you really know them, when you have really mm-hmm. made a connection, mm-hmm. you realize they deserve coverage. So do the Iraqi people. So the conflict overall deserves everyone's attention. But I have chosen, and my career path with the Pentagon has been that I cover the military. So I have made a connection with them, and I do. I mean, certainly there are people in the military who are bad people, just like in the society in general. But I know those people over there try hard, and I think it's essential that we cover it. I mean, I've been going over there so long, I was joking with some of the soldiers last time when I was in Ramadi, and listening to a briefing, they'll often brief the generals, and I was traveling around with a general, and I didn't know the soldier who was briefing, but he started talking about how many AIF they'd detained, which means anti-Iraqi forces. And afterwards I said, so you must have been over here year two of the war, right? And he said, how did you know that? And I said, because you call the enemy AIF. That's what they called them then. They don't call them that anymore. I said, that's so yesterday. So he said, boy, that's amazing. You really have a long-term memory for this place. I said, yes, I do. So it has been one of those things that I, from the beginning, when your own children grow up, you don't really see them grow up and progress, and then the relatives come in and say, oh, look how much he's grown.
Right.
I sort of feel like the relative in Iraq, that I can go in every few months and see what I think is happening on the ground. I never try to come back and say, I have the answers, or, you know, this is definitively that because I saw this. But I feel like I have a deep sense of the place.
Yeah.
And I think that's a valuable contribution to journalism, I hope.
I agree. Martha Raddatz is our guest. Her book is The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Martha, of course, the chief White House correspondent for ABC News, the network's former senior national security correspondent. She has covered national security and foreign policy for more than 12 years. We're welcoming phone calls for her, and we'll take them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Martha Raddatz is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Mary Lou from St. Paul. Hi, Mary Lou.
Yes, hi. What a wonderful program. I have two concerns. The veterans' wives that are going through, they don't have enough money. They're short of money. While their husbands are in Iraq. The other one, I'm concerned about the children and the widows in Iraq. We hear nothing about the devastation of them in their homes, how they've been, you know, injured and no medical supplies. They're devastated.
Boy, you'll if you read this book, you'll be even more devastated. This is one of my major concerns, and I have Bob Woodruff, as you know, who is doing what he can for the wounded. And you have the stories about the Walter Reed. And I think we as a nation have to really understand what these families go through right away and will be going through for decades. I tried to write about what this is 1 week in Iraq. It is an intense, narrow look at 1 week in Iraq, which I think tells the story of the entire war, even today. And I tried to focus, and I go back and forth between the families and the battlefront and how challenging it is for the families, the children. I mean, these are children who go to school in the morning and don't know if they're going to get word and taken out of class that their parent has been killed or wounded, or that the friend next to them lost their parent. I mean, this happens all the time. In these military posts all the time. You go out to Camp Pendleton in California, and the Marine families who've been deployed the 3-4 times, some of them even more, go down to Fort Hood where this took place, and that afternoon when they started getting word and you tried to find childcare for their children, but at the same time to gather around the wounded, and it is just a remarkably inspiring story about these families. Now, I have also seen, and this disturbs me so much, and particularly in the reserve and guard families, that if you have a badly injured soldier or Marine, and I have seen a lot of them, and you have a spouse, a wife who, say, is a teacher, and she lives in Minnesota, and I'm saying that not because you're calling, I believe, from Minnesota, but because this is a true story, and she had young children, her husband was in Bethesda Naval Hospital, and she had to quit her job, so they lose that income to care for him. Then she had to find child care for her young children to make sure that they were well cared for and not thinking and disturbed about their father at all times, and their mother was gone in the middle of this trauma. I mean, the complications of these things are just enormous. One of the reasons that I know about all of this is because I became involved in a fund that the Marine Corps has called the Semper Fi Fund. And I thought it was the most amazing charity because I was looking for places to give money. to help the wounded, and this was one that you gave the money, and they literally turned it over to these Marine families, no question asked, in the hospital. Do you have your rent paid? Do you have child care? Do you need to, more than the military will offer you, airfare, you know, so many times a month or weeks, or who gets to come? And, I mean, the military doesn't offer, obviously, okay, and your mother can come out, and your two kids, and your in-laws, and everybody else. I mean, obviously, families want to rally around, and they don't have the money to do that often. So this was a marvelous fund that I saw really save family lives for doing that. But I think this is something the country has to think about for decades and decades. The attitude of some of these people after they've been wounded is fantastic. You can go in and you can see amputees who are just, I want to go back, I want to figure out a way to go back, or I'm going to do something productive on the outside, and have these tremendous attitudes. But I worry very much down the road, when they're away from their buddies, when they're away from their unit, when their families have had to go back to work, their mental state, and how we keep those young Americans motivated and let them know we're proud. No matter how we feel about the war, that's, to me, a principal thing we should be doing.
And some of the people who were in this battle that you described so vividly relive that battle all the time. They're suffering from post-traumatic stress, right? They'd like to get out of Sadr City, but they can't.
Right. I mean, I do think there's post-traumatic stress. I know Sergeant Miltenberger has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I've talked to him about that, and he said a very touching thing to me, which was, he said, I don't think I have it. And I said, well, how often do you think about that day? How often do you think of that day when you were in back of that bloody truck with people dying all around you? And he said, I think about it all the time. I think about it, you know, three or four times a day at the very least. I'm haunted by it. And I said, well, Robert, then maybe you do have that. And do you want to stop thinking about it? Maybe you should talk to someone. And he said, ma'am, I'll never stop thinking about it. But I'm okay thinking about it. And I thought, you know, he's probably right. How could you possibly stop thinking about that?
Yeah.
And I do think, I mean, just from my, and again, talking to him last night, and I hadn't seen him for a long time, he is a different person. Everyone who served over there will be a different person when they come home because they've had these profound experiences. We have to help them deal with it. And whether that's listening to their stories, tell me about, I take my children up to Bethesda Naval Hospital on Christmas Eve, and because they have a small dinner for the wounded Marines, and my kids who are older, my son's 15 and my daughter's 26, but they said, what do we say? And I said, just ask them how they got injured, where they were, what happened. And it was a really, it's been a wonderful experience for my kids to meet these Americans and to appreciate that.
How about you, Martha? Are you a different person?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, I have covered wars before. I was in Bosnia. I think the length of time and the horrendous way people die and how suddenly they're taken from their families and how much of that I've seen changes you. Someone the other day said, oh, how do you stay objective? And I said, I'm not objective about this. How can you be objective about people dying? I feel terrible that people are dying. I'm not, am I objective that these are brave Americans doing their best? I guess I'm not. But I think anyone who has a heart, I don't think it's my job to be sterile in what I do. I have passion for what I do. I know my sources and the people I cover respect me and know if there's bad news out of the military, they're going to get that in their face too, without question. And the people in the military I respect know that bad things in the military should come out, and they want them out. So I'm certainly objective when I cover the news, but the pain Americans have suffered or the pain their families have suffered, I don't have to be objective about.
Right, yeah. Thanks so much, Mary Lou, for your call. Arlene is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. One of the casualties of this war is about 60,000 military marriages have been broken by this war. and nobody speaks to that. And also the fact is, what are we going to leave behind? These people are living with the horrors that we face with these soldiers. They're living with them all around their population. What kind of children are we going to leave behind there?
I think the issue of divorce in the military is a serious issue, and that is, I would say without question, because of the numerous deployments. I don't know how you keep a family together when you're expected to go back again and again and again. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the strongest marriages, I don't know how they do it. I think that is a problem that will be covered more and more. You are right. It doesn't get a lot of attention. I think it has certainly had some. I think the effects on the kids, with not having a parent around or sometimes two parents who are deployed. I mean, this is a volunteer military, but I don't think anyone in the volunteer military imagined they'd be deployed two or three, four times in a period of 4 or 5 years. Some of the special forces, 7 times.
Oh, my gosh.
Since 9/11. 7 times. Mm. And one of the commanders actually said to me, you know, I really worry that these guys are becoming one-dimensional people. We send them over so much. Mm-hmm. They, as strong a marriage as they may have, you get disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And it is such an intense experience. And you don't want to frighten your family. And I think it's one of the reasons I connected so well with the families and the soldiers is because I felt like a bridge between them, is that I've been on the front line with the soldiers, and I'm a wife and mom, so I can completely mm-hmm. understand what the families are going through. And, you know, I'll joke with them and say, boy, I couldn't have done this, just couldn't have done this, and what you're doing back here as a family. So I think that is a serious problem. I think some of these guys do a wonderful job of reconnecting with their family and in immersing themselves in family life, and others don't. Others just can't, or they're young. They're not experienced. I think the older couples are doing well. I know Colonel Valesky's family, and for this second deployment, is they're terrific, and they know how to keep in touch, and they know what that requires, and they know it takes some discipline to, you know, talk or be on email every day and make sure that you stay connected in ways, or that you'll drift. So I think it's a challenge. I think it's a challenge they face, and again, we have not had to sacrifice at all. I think the children are terrific. I mean, but I mean, really, as I said, I mean, can you imagine sitting in a class and having your child know that his friend might lose their dad or mom, or you know? I also want to say this, that my book goes, like, sounds totally gender stereotype, and it is. It has the wives and it has the soldiers who are male on the front line. In this battle, that was the case. It's an infantry battalion, right. So they did not have women in the infantry battalion, mm-hmm. but there are brave, incredible female soldiers and Marines on the front lines over there as well.
Mm-hmm. Martha, what about this idea, and it's discussed in by some of the wives here, that many of them go into a marriage knowing that perhaps the first spouse is the military?
Yes, you're talking about Leanne Valesky, mm-hmm. who said you have to, if you marry someone in the military, you have to realize you're the other woman,
mm-hmm.
and the military comes first. And she said, and if you don't realize that, and that your husband has to do what he does, you're going to be a miserable, miserable person. Leanne Valesky is one of these. Just she actually was in the military briefly, so she understands it, and they have a young son. And she found ways to contribute to her husband's military career in a way that was good for her, in a way that made her feel like she was doing something, which she is, and she helped form these family readiness groups, which is she makes sure that she's the liaison between the family and the military and provides them in times of need any, you know, whatever she can help provide, and gets these care teams together for the wounded. She is a really remarkable woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to see her this weekend. I'm so excited. I'm going out
great.
To Texas.
Great. Thanks so much, Arlene, for the call. Let's go to Mary next from Central Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I've got a son over there, and he is at the 28th Combat Support Hospital. Do you know where that's at?
Yes.
That's kind of right down by Solder City.
Yes.
And his job is he has to track you know, the wounded come in, he has to track what kind of treatment they got, what medications, everything from the time they get there till they leave for Germany, I guess.
So he's like the S1 for keeping track, yes.
Right, and when he calls, you know, he doesn't talk about it much, but they are just overwhelmed. He is just exhausted when he calls, you know. I mean, it's been a 12-hour day, and it's just, I don't know.
I can't imagine the intensity of what he's saying. Can't imagine. Mm. And there's nobody better than those who are staffing those combat support hospitals.
And I think part of the reason that he went back in, you know, he was out. I suppose they could have made him come back in anyway. But I think the reason he did go back in voluntarily, but I think it was just because he thought they don't have enough experienced medics.
And I think a lot of, you know, I'm astonished sometimes about the reenlistment rate. But I think you've got it right there. I mean, they feel a responsibility that they feel like, okay, I have to keep doing this or someone else will have to do it. And I should go back because I'm experienced. I know how to do it. I've been there. But those combat support hospitals, and not only, you know, not only are they treating Americans, but if Iraqis are wounded, they'll bring them right in too.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in one of the combat support hospitals, may have been that one, that there was, a couple of years ago, there was a soldier who'd been shot by a sniper that day, and we were going in to see him. And right across from him was somebody they thought might have shot him, but they were treating him as well.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
It's not right next to him. I mean, they wouldn't do that, but it was incredible.
I imagine.
So it was incredible.
What about this disconnect? You're right at one point that Americans don't really, or you've said this, don't feel connected to this war. How are we not connected, and what difference does it make that we're not connected?
I think we as Americans support our troops. We are not going to have a replay of the Vietnam generation.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that really mean? I mean, I just think, you know, we look at the troops as our football team, but we can go home after the game and we can go back to our families and we can go shopping and we can go on vacation, that we have not had to sacrifice anything. Now, how you do that in your own way, I don't know. I mean, whether it's giving money, whether it's volunteering, whether it's making sure if you see a member of the military, you thank them, whether it's whatever you do, I think we have to connect ourselves to this war. I hear people say, you know, I'm tired of hearing about it, or I'm this
oh,
or
sure.
I'm that. We can't be tired of it. I mean, it's one of the reasons this book meant so much to me, is because I felt it was a story that hadn't been told. It's not a policy book. It's not political. It is about our soldiers and their families. 1 week in the lives of these soldiers and families, and it gives you a glimpse of what that life is like. The very least people can do is at least know who's fighting for us, mm-hmm. know the sacrifice of the families, and whether that's reading about them, whether that's reading the names of the dead in the paper and not just letting them become numbers, Or just educating yourself about the war in general. And how do you feel if the troops would pull out? What do you think might happen? Should they stay? Should they go? Don't just say those things. Know the consequences. Know why you feel the way you
mm-hmm.
feel.
Mm-hmm.
And know always that this isn't just a policy discussion. We've got probably 150,000 Americans on the ground now, and as you know, we're in the middle of a surge, and that's going up. But know what kind of conflict they're in. I'm thrilled because this book is very graphic in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, for the families and for the soldiers, but they think it tells their story and lets people know what
mm-hmm.
they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Mary, do you worry every day about your son, or are you at peace with the work he's doing there? Mary's gone. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Zach from Green Bay next. Hi, Zach.
Good morning. I can't help but feel a bit irritated by the concern that Ms. Raddatz now expresses for the troops, given that I remember what the White House Press Corps was doing in the months before the war, which was basically being extremely differential, unquestioning and super careful to stay within the box and context of discussion, which was defined by the administration. And I don't blame Ms. Raddatz for being particularly unquestioning of this administration until maybe the last year or so. I think that's a problem of our media system and the ownership system of our media. But what I would ask Ms. Raddatz is that if she is in fact that concerned about the treatment of the veterans and the injured veterans, that in her future reporting, she would start naming the names of those responsible for the funding and administration of our injured veterans, which are namely a Republican Congress.
Martha.
Well, first of all, I wasn't covering the White House when the war began. I was covering the Pentagon and the State Department. And frankly, I remember standing out in front of the UN after Colin Powell's speech and questioning the evidence that he put forward. Mm-hmm. And I proudly must say that I think I'm one of the only reporters that went on the air right after that with Peter Jennings. And I said I thought it was circumstantial evidence and mm-hmm. there was no new evidence. But the press, as a general, in general, I think we all needed to do more, and we continue to have to do more. I know it's easy for people to say you haven't done this, you haven't done that. I think people certainly are starting to name people who haven't funded and to point the finger at people who are letting down Walter Reed. I do think the press is much more aggressive about this now. I think in some ways certainly we did not question and will question ourselves for years to come about a lot of things we probably failed to do. But I do think there are a lot of us who have tried to tell the story in a way we can, and I think I try to do my part, and I hope we all do.
Soldiers always end, you write, end up fighting battles that someone else puts them in. It's one thing people understand least about the military. They're not all rah-rah for war.
No, in fact, they're probably the last to be rah-rah for war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're around them, and they'll be the most careful and want everything thought out before anybody goes into war. Clearly, there were a lot of mistakes going into this war. Clearly, no one planned mm-hmm. for the aftermath mm-hmm. of what happened. And then you had a Secretary of Defense who was dismissing it when it started happening, who refused to call it an insurgency, who, you know, was calling the enemy dead-enders and looting happens and things like that, which only exacerbated the problem. And, you know, my days at the Pentagon during that time, it was impossible to get straight answers about this.
Martha Raddatz is our guest, and her book is The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Martha is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News, who spent a number of years now covering all aspects of the war in Iraq, and she goes there every couple months, and she has done a lot of frontline reporting to the battle zone. She looks at the emotional toll that the war has taken on those who have served there. The Long Road Home is a very personal book about heroism and about bravery displayed not only by those who are there, but by the families who are here as well. The story begins on April 4, 2004, when a platoon of soldiers from Fort Hood, Texas, only days after they have arrived in Iraq to begin a peacekeeping mission in the Shiite district of Baghdad known as Sadr City, is savagely ambushed and pinned down during a routine patrol. So we're going to continue with Martha in a moment. Our lines are busy, but just keep trying. You ought to be able to get through. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the author of Commander in Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. Our guest is the author of that book, who's written a number of other books, including Old Soldiers Never Die, The Life of Douglas MacArthur, a book on Ulysses Grant, a book on Lincoln's War, and so that's tomorrow during this time period. Martha Raddatz is with us now, and we go back to phone calls. Bob from Superior is next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Martha, thank you for writing the book.
Thank you.
My son-in-law is in the book.
Oh, he is? Who is it?
Captain Jeffrey Oliver, who's now a major.
Oh, yes. Oh, fantastic.
I got the book last night and at the bookstore, and I'm into Sadr City, just the first two chapters.
Good, good, good.
I can understand what you're talking about. My daughter went through many of the things that the wives had gone through, and it was very, very, very revealing.
It's intense. You really understand it, don't you?
Kathleen?
Yes.
Captain Oliver was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Superior, and he was on, at that time they call it WSSU, but he was a broadcaster.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Hmm.
But thank you very, very much. It was it's in depth, and it is really touching me because many of the phone calls I had with my daughter and my son-in-law are there.
Hmm. And how are they doing now?
He's doing fine. He's going to run a PA school in Fort Bragg.
Oh, great. Great. So another move for them.
Yes.
That's the other thing about military life that they know, certainly,
yes.
Is that you move around a lot. I know that General Corelli and Beth Corelli, Mrs. Corelli, I think have moved, just made their 28th move.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I met Colonel Abrams at Fort Hood back a few years before the deployment was made. Quite a gentleman.
Let me tell a quick story about Colonel Abrams that's not in the book. He was the brigade commander, which means that 3,000 soldiers, and then they break down to battalions and companies and platoons. So Colonel Abrams is the son of Creighton Abrams, General Creighton Abrams, who was the Vietnam general and for whom the Abrams tank is named. And Colonel Abrams is a straight-ahead, you know, always the colonel, military man. And he, when I interviewed him in Sauter City, and it's one of the reasons to me that this family side of this is so important. When I interviewed Colonel Abrams, I was there just as they were ending the deployment. So, I'd interviewed him before, but this last, they were days away from returning back home. And I just said, well, just tell me what this has been like for you. And he started talking in his kind of clipped manner. And then he just said, but it's the families. And he broke down crying.
Hmm.
And to have someone like Colonel Abrams do that, and he was very upset about it. He called me afterwards and said, I'm totally humiliated that I did that. Are you going to run that? And I said, Colonel Abrams, it is a beautiful moment, and it shows the depth of your pride for your families and the depth of your own pain. And he was okay with that. He knew that would happen. I remember that night when we ran it, Peter Jennings had tears in his eyes.
Hmm.
And also, Colonel Abrams emailed General Corelli that day and said, sir, I was interviewed today by Martha Raddatz, and I try to do the division proud, but I got emotional. I've let you all down.
Oh, my.
And General Corelli, who's a wonderful division commander, wrote back and said, if you'd done anything else, you would have let us down. So that is the military as well, and they do show emotion, they do feel pain, and they're feeling a lot of it lately.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. You know, a lot of us just watching your reports and watching the news and listening to this day after day after day, year after year, the bombings, and reading your book, and it wears you down, Martha, and I'm wondering, just from your perspective, we're debating all of this now, but you say at some point you shouldn't go into a war you don't know how to get out of, and that's the question we're asking now. What's the plan? How do we keep from hearing this horrible news all the time? It's just awful.
Well, I think I don't know. I mean, it's not up to me to decide how we get out of it, I guess. I mean, I hope the surge works. I hope it holds. If it does, we're not going to be able to get out right away. If people want this to succeed in a way, they will, I think, will be there for a very, very long time. To me, the way I get by day by day, and I know these things are tough to listen to day after day, but I also find stories like this so inspirational. When you hear what the soldiers have done and that they go back or that their families continue to support them, or if they don't, we have to still support them. And I just think there's inspiration to be found there. I mean, you go on the ground, and as horrible as it can be, and you know, I remember driving in a convoy in Ramadi a couple of weeks ago, and the soldiers and Marines were so proud to show progress they'd made, and to me they had, but it's still, I mean, they still see that ray of hope there, and yet you can look around, and I teased them, and I said, I think you guys have rose-colored blast glasses on, because there may be progress, but you've got rubble all around. We We have F-18s escorting us, Apache helicopters escorting us. You know, we have 300-pound doors on this armored Humvee. Look where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But then they still say, you know, we just have to keep looking at the progress and trying to forge ahead. And I think that's largely an attitude you see over there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob, so much for the call.
Thank you, Bob.
Scott from Antioch, Illinois. Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to get Martha's take on, I don't know, my opinion is I'm always surprised when people are surprised that the veterans, you know, this whole thing with Walter Reed, that they're not taken care of well, that they're sort of warehoused. I mean, you can go back through history if you look at you know, the vets trying to get the bonus army. If you look at as recently as the first Gulf War, people, you know, denying that they were exposed to just, you know, all of the things they were exposed to. And it just surprises me when, you know,
people are surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the amazing things about this is the numbers of wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not prepared for the number of wounded, and we've got this, you know, sensational body armor and protection now, so we have people who in other conflicts without that body armor would be dead are alive today, and they need care. And I think the system just is not prepared to cope with those numbers. I mean, they're enormous numbers, and I think, you know, further down the line, we won't be prepared to cope with some of the emotional problems unless we start thinking about this now. But it's true. People always seem to be surprised, and I guess we shouldn't have been.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Diane from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering what Martha's comment is about the dead and wounded Iraqis and how they're coping, and does the lack of a breadwinner or lack of jobs for Iraqis encourage them to attack soldiers that if they had work... You know, we have all those contractors doing the work. If they had work, would they not take jobs building bombs?
I think that's an excellent point, and you are right on target. And there are studies that show if we could just get people jobs, the violence would start subsiding, I mean, by tenfold, because you've got people who are dying every day, Iraqis, in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. They don't have jobs. They lose a spouse. They lose a son. And someone comes along and says, hey, I'll give you $100 if you'll build a bomb. And their family's starving to death. They do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think studies of counterinsurgency for decades show that if you can get reconstruction going, if you can get people employed, that is the way to solve these problems. And I remember on my very first trip into Iraq in 2003, the general said then, and they still say it today, there is no military solution to this problem. We have to get teams in there and do reconstruction. Unfortunately, it's a terrible catch-22, because if you don't have security, then you can't really start these reconstruction projects. If you don't have reconstruction projects, then you don't have security.
Yeah. Ah! Make sure to throw your hands up. Ah. Thanks,
true.
Diane, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Ray from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Martha. I'm fascinated by the book, and I heard you describing in detail that our boys had to shoot through a line of women and children in this specific firefight in Sadr City. And that's just so mind-blowing to me. Are we torturing women and children as well as shooting them to... save ourselves? I mean, what in the world are we doing if our boys are being forced? And then how do they go home to their children and wives knowing that some of their own buddies and maybe they have themselves had to kill women and children?
You know, the scene in that book, I would not have known about unless the soldiers told me about that. And the lieutenant who was the platoon leader told me about that without hesitancy. The 1st Cavalry Division was very open. And they said to their soldiers, you just tell the truth. This was the Mahdi militia put children and women in front of them and attacked on both ends of the alley where the soldiers were pinned down, firing over the heads of the children and continuing to attack and go forward with the troops. And the lieutenant said, He had 19 soldiers there. At some point, he calculated at what point the soldiers would be completely overrun. He has children of his own, and I think it was kill or be killed. He was disgusted that they would put children in this battle, but I think they felt they had no choice at that point. They obviously tried to avoid killing the children, but it became chaos when the Mahdi militia began attacking hundreds of them on both ends of an alley, or they would have killed all 19 soldiers. I think that's something else people have to cope with, that he told me about that story in great detail. I think tells you something, that at least they're talking about it, at least they're acknowledging that that happened. And he said anybody who would do that, who would put a child in front of them as a shield, I mean, they were disgusted by it, but horrified and felt that was the decision they had to make in the end.
Yeah. Martha, thanks so much for being with us and
thank
for writing
you
the
so
book.
Much.
Thanks, Martha. Martha Raddatz, Chief White House Correspondent for ABC News. The book is The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family. It has just been published by Putnam. Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee. Copies of the show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 38D. 38D. News ahead will return with more conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.